This was perhaps the hardest of all of the four talks about Bible commentators for me to put together, because some of you might know that I've spent most of my academic career writing about Rashbam, Rashi's grandson. And as I was putting together today's class, I kept saying, oh, I have to put this text in. Oh, I have to put that other. There were just too many things that I had to say. And my biggest problem was getting this down to an hour long class. And I hope that I succeeded. Just a few introductory words about Rashbam. Rashbam was, as most of you know, Rashi's grandson. Rashi only had daughters. Most historians say that Rashi had three daughters. There's one opinion that he had four daughters. All of his daughters married students of his, and they produced some great rabbis, including Rashbam, Shmuel ben Meir. Rashi's student, married Rashi's daughter Yocheved. And as far as we can tell, Rashbam was the oldest grandson, and he had a pretty close relationship with his grandfather. We'll see some echoes of that in the Torah commentary, but in halachic works, which it's probable that both Rashi and Rashbam spent most of their life working on their halachic works and the minority of their life working on their Bible commentaries. We know that in halachic works, Rashbam is a disciple of his grandfather Rashi, and that Rashi depended on him. And towards the end of the life of his life, Rashi dictated to Rashbam, his grandson, and his Talmid Mufak, his kind of main lead student, a halachic work of his when it was more difficult for Rashi to write. It's very hard to find any ways in which Rashbam deviates in any significant way from his grandfather's method in his halachic works. However, we will see that Rashbam felt that it was necessary to write a new Torah commentary, and he'll tell us that why he decided that it was important to write a new Torah commentary. This Torah commentary that Rashbam wrote had a totally different fate than Rashi's Torah commentary. I used to tell students at the university that we don't have a fixed scientific critical edition of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, nor do we have a fixed scientific critical edition of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, for two different reasons. The reason we don't have one for Rashi is because there are too many manuscripts, and the people who have put together the manuscript families, hundreds of manuscripts of Rashi from pre-modern times survived. And the differences between them are very great. And people argue about whether the Leipzig manuscript is the best one or the Munich manuscript is the best one. And the differences are significant. And that's why we don't have one text that everybody can agree upon is the good scientific text of Rashi's commentary on the Torah. Rashbam's commentary on the Torah has the precise opposite problem. We have a grand total of zero full manuscripts of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. Rashbam, we know so few things about his life, but he was probably born in 1080 or between 1080 and 1085. In other words, when Rashi was 40 to 45 years old. And then Rashi died at age 65. And so that would mean that Rashbam was 20 to 25 years old when his grandfather died, leaving enough time for him to have studied for a number of years with his grandfather. So Rashbam clearly writes this Bible commentary of his after Rashi's death. I'm pretty convinced he didn't write it until he was in his 60s in the 1140s. And in the 12th century and in the 13th century and slightly in the 14th century, people are quoting this commentary, and then it seems as if the commentary like falls off the face of the earth, and people stop quoting it. You know, great Bible commentators who lived after the 14th century, like Abarbanel or Sforno, they never knew of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. They read whatever commentaries on the Torah they could put their hands on, but they couldn't find Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. They knew that he'd written it, but it basically got lost. And why do commentaries on the Torah get lost in the days before the printing of books? It's because nobody bothers copying the manuscripts, and manuscripts don't always last forever. And they get torn apart, destroyed, lost, whatever. And unless there are lots of people copying the manuscripts, the commentary doesn't survive. At the end of the 17th century, a wealthy rabbi in Germany named David Oppenheim, who lived in Worms in Germany and later on went on to become the chief rabbi of Prague. He was a bibliophile. He went around trying to collect old books and manuscripts, and he writes in his diary that he got invited to go to an attic where there were some old manuscripts, and he picked up a piece of parchment, and he saw that it was eaten on both ends by rodents. And he started reading it, and it was Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. And Rashbam refers to himself in this commentary, the Torah, self-referential. He says, "I, Samuel, the son of Rabbi Meir, the grandson of Rashi," you have to talk with Rashi, we'll see that text. And so Oppenheim found this text. For those of you who are listening to this from Toronto or Thornhill, some of you might know Professor Josh Toplitsky, who grew up in Thornhill, and he just wrote a fascinating book about David Oppenheim, about this German rabbi who was a bibliophile, and Rashbam plays a significant role there, although Oppenheim saved so many books and so many manuscripts. And we saved the one surviving manuscript of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. This manuscript was passed down from hand to hand among many different famous Jews. It eventually ended up in the city library in Munich. And we know that it was there in 1939, and it has never been seen since. So there are actually now no full manuscripts of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, and all of the editions that we have are based on that one manuscript that we had until 1939. Okay. So that's a little bit of introduction about Rashbam, and now let's look at what we find in this commentary. So Rashbam, for reasons that we won't go into here, went into in the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev and commentary on Genesis chapter 37, went into a long excursus about why he was writing this commentary on the Torah. And here's what he writes: Yaskilu v'avinu o'avei sechel, mashalim dunu rabotenu ki ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. Let those who love reason understand the rule that a verse never departs from its pshat. It never departs from its plain meaning. We can do lots of things with biblical verses, but whatever we do with biblical verses, they're still the pshat. This is a Talmudic line: ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. It appears in the Talmud not that many times, because the Talmud, as Rashbam is about to say, doesn't actually talk about pshat, doesn't talk about the plain meaning, doesn't talk about the simple meaning of the biblical text very often. But remember, if you have seichel, if you are somebody who loves reason, then you should remember that no matter what you do with a biblical verse, there's still this thing called the pshat. And then he gives a little apology for what he's going to do in this commentary of his. Although it is true that the main purpose of the Torah is to teach us laws through hints, in the plain meaning of the text or through extraneous language in the text or through the 32 rules of interpretation of Rabbi Yose the Galilean or the 13 principles of Rabbi Ishmael. The most important thing that is done with the Torah is actually what was done by the rabbis in the Talmud and in the Midrashim, who use Midrashic method to explain the Torah. Okay, I'll admit to you that when I was young and I looked at this text and I saw I saw Rashbam saying this, that that's the most important thing, I didn't know whether to believe him. I was suspicious that he was maybe just saying this because he wanted, if you'll pardon me, he wanted to sound frum. And so he was saying that that's more important. But as the years went on and I studied Rashbam more, I have no doubt that he is totally sincere about this, that that is the most important level of meaning of the Torah, the level of meaning that the rabbis came up with when they offered their midrashim, which we know are so often very, very difficult, very, very different, sorry, from the pshat of the biblical text. I once heard a lecture given by a friend of mine here in Jerusalem. I'll mention her name in case any of you have heard of her, Rivka Bash, and she talked about Rashbam being a very modest person. We are going to see very soon that Rashbam was not a particularly modest person. And I went up to Rivka afterwards and I said to her, Rivka, really? Rashbam, a modest person? And Rivka, who's a very smart person, said to me, Marty, how many people do you know who write in the introduction to their book that their book is not the most important book that has been written on the subject, and that the other books that have been written on the subject are more important? And Rivka is right. That's actually what he's doing here. He's saying that if you want to see the most important level of interpretation of the Bible, then look at what the rabbis said. And okay, so then he goes on and says, והראשונים מתוך חסידותם נתעסקו לנטות אחרי הדרשות שהן עיקר ומתוך כך לא הורגלו בעומק פשוטו של מקרא. The earliest scholars, due to their piety, it's because they were frum, it's because they were pious, spent most of their time on Midrash, which is the most important area, method of interpretation of the text. Accordingly, they never really attuned themselves to the profundity of the plain meaning of scripture. They missed something. You know, they were spending their time, understandably, they were spending their time on this really important level, the Midrashic level, because, you know, we Jews aren't Karaites. We don't follow the plain meaning of the text in our halakha. Our halakha is based on the Midrash. That's the most important thing. And so he says, I understand why the Talmudic rabbis actually ignored pshat. They didn't attune themselves. They didn't train themselves to pay attention to this. And beyond that, and since the rabbis taught that studying the Bible is of but incomplete merit, and there's nothing more meritorious than studying the Talmud, accordingly, they never really attuned themselves to the plain meaning of scripture. That they understood that the important thing for a religious Jew is that a religious Jew should understand the Midrashic method and the Midrashic level of interpretation of the text, and they should not be paying that much attention. It isn't so important to be paying attention to the pshat level of interpretation of text. So I can understand why they actually ignored this. And that leaves something for me to write about because they didn't write about this. That's not what they were looking at. He goes on. Uchadam Rinan, and he quotes a Talmudic passage. It's written in the tractate Shabbat of the Talmud. I was 18 years old. I had studied the entire Talmud, and I had never learned that a verse never departs from its plain meaning. He quotes a Talmudic rabbi who says this kind of humorous line. He says, you know, I've been studying Talmud, and I've mastered Talmud, and no one ever told me that there's any importance to the plain meaning of the biblical text. I never heard this idea before. Who said, "Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto"? That's what we're doing in the Talmud, is we're taking the Bible and removing it from its pshat and giving it a midrashic meaning. Okay, so that's his kind of apology, defense of what he's doing here. And now he says something about his grandfather. The Gam Rabbeinu Shlomo Avi Imi Meir Enei HaGola Sheperash Torah Nevi'im Uktuvim Natan Lev Lefaresh Pshuto Shel Mikra Vafani Shmuel Ben Rabbi Meir Chatano Zatzal Nitvakachti Imo Lefana Vohodali Sheilu Hayalo Pnai Haya Tzarich Lasot Perushim Acherim Lefi HaPeshatot HaMitchadshim B'chol Yom. In English, Rabbi Solomon, my maternal grandfather, who illumined the eyes of the diaspora, that's a great compliment to his grandfather, also attempted, when he commented on the Tanakh, to explain the plain meaning of the text. I, Samuel, the son of his son-in-law Meir, often argued with him to his face. He had admitted to me that if only he had more time, he would revise his comments based on insights into the plain meaning of the text that are newly thought of day by day. A beautiful expression of Rashbam here, Hapshatot HaMitchadshim B'chol Yom, the newly thought of understandings of the biblical text. And these are pshat understanding of biblical text. You might think that once you've figured out the pshat, you've figured out the pshat, and then there's nothing more to say about it. No. Rashbam says that on the pshat level, you can have, as you're studying the text, you can have newly thought of insights day by day. I've always wondered about this report on the conversation that Rashbam's reporting on the conversation that he had with his grandfather here, that he used to argue with Rashi, and Rashi used to say to him, if only I had time, I would be changing my commentary on the Torah. I see that some questions have come in, so I'm going to try to answer them. Somebody asked, didn't Hillel Novetzky, who just got his PhD at Haifa University, recently find Rashbam on the beginning of Bereishit? Excellent question. The answer is no. He did not find Rashbam on the beginning of Bereishit. He reconstructed Rashbam on the beginning of Bereishit. I'll just show you show and tell here. There's his 500-page doctoral dissertation here that comes in two volumes here, in which he tried to gather together quotations of Rashbam's commentary and put together what he thinks is a reconstruction. And it's a beautiful job that he did. And you can find it online at this wonderful website called alatorah.org. But no, he did not find a manuscript that had Rashbam. He found a lot of quotations of Rashbam from the early years. And so using this, he reconstructed, he would say, 30 to 40% of Rashbam's commentary on the beginning of Bereishit, which was lost. I told you that when David Oppenheim found that manuscript, he reported that mice had eaten the manuscript at the two ends of the manuscript. And that's why the commentary of Rashbam, the standard printed commentary of Rashbam, is missing most of the opening chapters, most of the 17 opening chapters of Bereishit. And this fine scholar who lives here in Jerusalem, Hillel Novetzky, just put it together. Somebody also asked the question, why does Rashbam write this excursus here in the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev? And the answer is, kein man weiß nicht. Nobody really knows. There are all sorts of theories on the subject. Nothing convincing has ever been written about this. My guess is because he was planning on saying something really surprising in his commentary on Genesis chapter 37. And so he's trying to soften the blow. And we'll see that later on in today's class. We will see the surprising thing that he writes in his commentary on Genesis chapter 37. Okay, now to get back to Rashbam's quote, reporting of the conversation that he had with his grandfather. I said that I really think I wrote an article about this one time. I think that Rashbam didn't write this commentary on the Torah until at least 35 years after Rashi died. And, you know, if I now, in my 60s, reported back, I didn't know any of my grandfathers. They both died before I was born, but I did know my grandmothers. If I reported now on a conversation that I had with one of my grandmothers more than 35 years ago, how accurate would be my reporting? No one knows. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Rashbam is reporting accurately, that Rashbam, that his grandfather really did say to him, if only I had time, I would revise my commentary based on newly thought of insights into the plain meaning of the text day by day. And there is actually some evidence from a third party, from a great rabbi, a contemporary rabbi named Yitzhak Or Zarua, who tells us that Rashi was extremely impressed with his grandson's understanding of the biblical text. But you know, when you read this commentary here, okay, I see here. Somebody's challenging my translation here. Why do I translate it as often argued with him when the word often isn't there in the Hebrew? You are right, the word isn't there. But this nitvakachti imo ulefanav, I don't think that this is a suggestion about a one-time occurrence. It sounds to me like he's describing something that went on an ongoing basis in their relationship. But I always wondered, you know, now that I'm a grandfather, I have always wondered, let's assume that Rashi actually said to him, oh, if only I had time, I would be revising my commentary on the Torah. You know, I really wish that I was there to know what tone of voice Rashi said that to Rashbam in. He could have said, boy, those are real insights into the text that you have. If I had time, I would be changing my commentary on the Torah. Or he might be saying, as some of us grandfathers have occasionally said to a grandson, oh, that's brilliant what you said there. And if I had time, I would change. And so I don't really know what tone of voice Rashi said this to Rashbam in, and we can only guess. Okay, so that's his first statement about his relationship with his grandfather. And he makes various other statements about his relationship with his grandfather that are very impressive and seem to imply that he's following in his grandfather's footsteps. Just to save time, I'll read this just in English. Whoever is loyal to God's words should never depart from the commentary of my grandfather, Rabbi Solomon, and shouldn't budge from it. For most of the laws and midrashic interpretations there are close to the plain meaning of scripture. All of them can be derived from the study of the superfluities of the language or changes in the wording. The midrashic idea that if some phrase is written that wasn't necessary, then it was being written in order that you would learn something from it. And then he writes, it's best that you grasp the one, my commentary, without letting go of the other one. So it's good to study them both. I'm not coming here to supplant Rashi's commentary on the Torah. I'm coming to supplement it so that when you study the Torah, you'll study Rashi and you'll study what I say. And he says similar things in his introduction to Parshat Mishpatim. Let those who love wisdom know and understand that my purpose, as I explained in Genesis, isn't to offer halachic interpretations wherein Haggadot and Halachot are derived from superfluities in scriptural language, even though such interpretations are the most essential ones. Those are the most important ones, the halachic interpretations. Some of these explanations can be found in the works of my mother's father, Rashi. But my purpose is to explain the plain meaning of scripture. He writes, Ani lefaresh pshutan shel nikraot bati. And for those of you who were here last week, that sounds awfully like what Rashi said in his commentary, Vani lo bati ella lifshuto shel mikra. And Rashbam is saying, no, it's I, Rashbam, who came lifshuto shel mikra. You want the halachic understandings, then read Rashi's commentary. Nevertheless, it is the halachic level of interpretation that is the most essential one. As the rabbi said, halacha uproots the plain meaning of the biblical text. That sometimes halacha comes along and the pshat like disappears, because of the rabbi's reading of the text. Again, this sounds very complimentary towards his grandfather. However, in the 1980s, a scholar named Moshe Sokolov found a document that people are convinced was written by Rashbam. It might be the appendix to his Torah commentary. It might be an answer that he wrote to a student who sent him an inquiry and said to him, could you please explain what the difference is between your Torah commentary and the Torah commentary of your grandfather? Okay, so I'll read again in the English. Those of you who can follow the Hebrew can read the Hebrew on the side there. If readers encounter older commentaries that lean in the directions of other pshat explanations of different types than found in my works, some of you have read stuff before that looks like it's pshat, and you think that that's pshat, they should consider that those explanations do not conform to the way of the world or to the knowledge gained by humans, or they do not conform to the meaning of the verse. People before me, this is why I told my friend Rivka that it was hard to believe when she said that Rashbam was a very modest person, because he says, people before me did not understand what pshat is. I understand what pshat is. Other people never understood correctly what pshat is. I am unable to explain at length, to explain the logic of all the difficulties involved in those commentaries, other than a few here and there, for there would not be enough ink or quills or parchment to hold descriptions of all the difficulties involved. You want me to explain what's not good about all those Torah commentaries that were written before my time? I don't have enough paper. I don't have enough ink to explain all of these things. Okay, then he goes on. In case you don't know which commentary he's dissing here and disagreeing with here, it's Rashi's. He says, look at what my grandfather, may the memory of the righteous be a blessing. Zechar tzadik livracha. So he's saying, he's expressing his respect for his grandfather while he's going to come down on him in language that is shocking. Look at what my grandfather explained considering the verse, Ki ha adam etz hasadeh lavo mipanecha b'matzor. Then he quotes Rashi's commentary, and then he writes, that interpretation is folly. Halo zeh hadavar hevel. Who would be so idiotic or foolish as to think that a tree does have the same powers as human beings? So that's how Rashi interpreted this verse, as meaning, is a tree like a human being? Rashbam said, what a silly way to interpret a biblical verse. Who thinks that a tree is like a human being? Why would the Torah have to say, is a tree like a human being? Everybody knows that a tree isn't a human being. Why would our Rabbi Moses have to tell us something like this, that it's not worthy of being heard? I, on the other hand, explained that verse well in a manner that conforms to the meaning of the verses and to the way of the world. Look at my commentary. You'll see a decent commentary on this verse. And Rashi here, Rashi flubbed it. And he didn't understand what pshat means. And then he gives another example. He quotes Rashi's interpretation of a verse in the book of Job. And he writes this too. Gam zeh hevel hu. This is, didn't Job realize it? And then he explains why Rashi's interpretation is hevel. Hevel is not a complimentary word to use about your grandfather's commentary on the Torah, his grandfather about whom you said, Zecher Tzadik Libracha. And so Rashbam has this really curious relationship with his grandfather as being his Talmid Mufak. Professor Ephraim Urbach, the great Talmudist there from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, said that he is convinced that when Rashi died, Rashbam took over the yeshiva. They had this relationship. When Rashi died, the head of the yeshiva, he says, for a while was Rashbam, until Rashbam's younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam, who was almost 10 years younger than Rashbam, took over the yeshiva in later years. Okay, so we see this surprising kind of attitude to his grandfather's commentary. From time to time, I'll give you no examples of this, but from time to time, I once estimated that it's about 10% of the time Rashbam writes the same thing that Rashi wrote in his commentary. And I've never quite figured out why he does that, because he says that you should also be reading Rashi's commentary and that you should have the two books beside each other. You should have a biblical text, you should have Rashi's commentary, you should have my commentary. So I don't know why he does that. But most of the time in his commentary, if you're looking for, if we talked last week about the idea of makashel Rashi, what's bothering Rashi. So the answer most of the time about makashel Rashbam, what's bothering Rashbam, is that Rashi's commentary is bothering Rashbam. And when you go through Rashbam's commentary and you see a comment, so often what he is trying to do is to explain why why Rashi's understanding of the verse is not correct. Just a few examples of this in the 25th chapter of Genesis, by Yosef Abraham, by Yikach Isha Ushmak Turah. After Sarah died, it says that Abraham married a woman whose name was Keturah, and Rashi writes, Keturah, Zo Hagar, this is Hagar. It's the same person that he married. This is, of course, midrashic to say that Keturah and Hagar are the same person as each other, two different names. But it does create a very interesting story when you think about it, that Abraham kicked Hagar out of his home because Sarah wanted her to be kicked out of the home. And then as soon as Sarah died, he invites Hagar to come back and be his wife again. It's a kind of interesting and touching story, but it's not the pshat. And Rashbam just writes, Lefi ha-pshat ein zo hagar. You know, if you're writing a pshat commentary on the Torah, there are two different names here of a person. One of them is named Keturah. The other one is named Hagar. And so why are you saying that these two are the same person? That one is kind of gentle. This next one is not all that gentle. And the blessing that Jacob gives to his children, the blessing that he gives to Yehuda, includes the line, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, you Judah, you're like a young lion, Miteref Bini Alita, you arose, you came up beyond Teref. Teref. It means the prey. But the word teref also resonates with the Joseph story when Jacob said, Tarof Toraf Yosef, that Yosef was torn apart by a wild animal. So Rashi writes there, Miteref mimasha chashadticha betarof toraf Yosef, silakta et atzmacha va'amarta mabetza. From the deed of which I suspected you when I said Joseph is torn in pieces, from that murderous deed you withdrew, saying, what profit is it if we slay our brother? Oh, I know that you did not want Yosef to be killed. And that's a very good thing. And so that's how Rashi understands this phrase, Miteref Bini Alita, that the phrase means you, Judah, accepted yourself, rose above the idea of destroying my son Yosef. To which Rashbam says, that's not what the words Miteref Bini Alita mean. I'll read them in English. You, Judah, my son, after you arise from preying on the nations, no enemy shall come to frighten you. Yehuda is being compared here to a lion who goes and attacks the other animals, and nobody frightens you. Rashbam is emphasizing that the word b'ni here is in the vocative. It's Yehuda is being addressed here as b'ni. That b'ni is not a reference to my son Yosef, but it's Yaakov turning to Yehuda and saying, b'ni, my son. So is the word b'ni talking to my son, or is it talking about that other son who isn't there? This is the true plain meaning of the text. B'ni readdresses Yehuda. Zehu ikar pshuto b'ni kfeilo shel Yehuda. It's like he said, Yehuda? And then he says to him, b'ni? Like you could talk to your son and you say, my son, I've got something to say to you. So b'ni is not talking about Yosef. And then Rashbam gives one of his standard insults. He says, "Bahamefarsho b'mechirat Yosef." Anybody who connects this verse to the sale of Joseph, lo yada b'shita shel pasuk v'lo b'chiluk te'amim klal. A person who thinks this verse is talking about the sale of Joseph has no understanding either of the context of the verse or of the punctuation of the cancellation signs. Those of you who know trop see that there's a tipa under mi teref, which separates it from the word b'ni. And according to Rashi's interpretation, Rashbam is suggesting there should be a mercha under mi teref and a tipa under b'ni. Don't follow cancellation. That's okay. We'll move on to something else. But he's saying that Rashi doesn't understand context, and he's offering a midrashic interpretation that does not go along with the cancellation signs. Another example: when Moshe's mother hides him, when she couldn't hide him no longer, she got a wicker basket for him and she caulked it with bitumen and pitch and she put the child into it and she placed it among the reeds by the bank of the river. Rashi says about caulking this basket with bitumen and with pitch, Rashi writes, with pitch, zephet outside, and with bitumen, chemar inside, in order that the righteous child might not smell the disagreeable odor of the pitch. And Rashbam, who seems to be like, you know, pardon me for putting it this way, but he seems to be mocking his grandfather's language. He says, with bitumen on the inside and pitch on the outside, so that the water would not penetrate into the basket. Why did he do it that way? Fregnish, you know, why two different? He's trying to close off the basket so the water doesn't come inside. You don't need this midrashic explanation. There are many people who have come to Rashi's defense, but what I'm trying to point out here is how Rashbam is troubled by the way in which his grandfather interpreted the Bible. And I would say that Rashi criticism began with Rashbam, and that so much of last week I mentioned Professor Eric Lowy's new book about Rashi commentaries, and Professor Lowy found a number of manuscripts from the medieval times that were never published of people who were not pleased with Rashi's commentary on the Torah. But I think that the first person that we know about who wasn't pleased with Rashi's commentary on the Torah was definitely his grandson, Rashbam. Criticism of Rashi is not the only thing that goes on in Rashbam's commentary. He was an extremely creative thinker who thought out of the box. And then going back to the story of the sale of Yosef, and going back to the question that somebody asked in the chat, why did Rashbam give this explanation in his commentary on chapter 37, it might be because he was laying the groundwork for his extremely surprising interpretation here of the story of the sale of Joseph. So it says there in the verses, I'll just summarize quickly. You can read the verses if you wish. They took Joseph, they threw him into the pit, and then they sat down to eat a meal, the brothers. And they looked and they saw that there was a caravan of Ishmaelites coming on its way to Egypt. Verse 26, Yehuda says, why should we kill our brother? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. And then we won't actually physically kill him because after all, he is our brother and our flesh and blood. And then they listened. Okay, now the important verse is verse 28 here. Vayavru anashim midyanim socharim vayimshechu vayalu et Yosef min abor vayimkeru et Yosef layishmaelim besrim kasef vayaviu et Yosef mitzrayma. Okay, so it's hard to translate this without giving away what the interpretation is. Some Midianite salesmen came by, and then Vayimshechu vayaalu et Yosef min habor. We'll get back to that phrase. Vayimkeru et Yosef vayishmaelim be'esrim kasef. And they sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And then they brought Joseph to Egypt. Rashbam, going against the entire grain of standard Jewish traditional interpretation of the verse, notices here that the brothers aren't mentioned in this sentence, in this verse. Previously, a couple of verses ago, it says that the brothers were eating, they were having a picnic. The brothers, writes Rashbam, were at their meal, sitting some distance from the pit so as to refrain from eating on the blood. You know, if you'd just thrown your brother into the pit and he's screaming from inside the pit and you wish to have a picnic, Rashbam says, and I think it makes sense, that you probably wouldn't sit there beside the pit. You would probably move away so that you wouldn't have to listen to your irritating little brother screaming from inside of the pit. So they moved somewhere else to have their picnic lunch. However, before the Ishmaelites arrived, different people, Midianites, passed by there. They saw Joseph in the pit, and they pulled him out, and those Midianites sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites. It is to be understood that the brothers did not know of the sale. Not only didn't they sell him, they didn't even know about the sale. And that's why it says in the continuation that Reuven went back to the pit and he saw that Yosef wasn't there. Rashi has to come up with some midrashic explanation about why it was that Reuven didn't know that they sold him if the brothers sold it. And Rashbam, thinking out of the box, comes up with a new interpretation of the verse here that says that it's actually the Midianites who were the ones who sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites. I will just take a fast break and answer one of the questions that came in the chat here. No, there isn't evidence that Rashbam is equally critical in his Talmudic commentary, although I think he amends the text much more often than Rashi does, but I actually wrote an article about that sometime too, and if you'd like, Jonathan, I can send you the article that I wrote about that, but in general, no. Yes. And then Rebecca says here that years later, standing in front of the Egyptian vizier, they say to each other, this is our punishment for what we did. Actually, what they say is, Aval ashrimim anachnu alachinu asher ra'inu tzarat nafsho behirchanano elenu v'lo shamanu. All they say is, we heard him begging for his life and we didn't listen to him. That doesn't mean that they said that they sold him. They know that they were responsible for it. Now, the big problem with Rashbam's interpretation is that, as Susanna says here in the chat, Joseph says years later, Mechartem Oti. Yes, that is a very good criticism of Rashbam's explanation, but Shmuel David Lutzato, Shadal in the 19th century, who came to the defense of Rashbam and writes three or four pages to try to prove that Rashbam is obviously right in his interpretation of the text. I think Shadal gave the best explanation. Yosef didn't know who sold him. He overheard his brothers saying, let's sell him. And then along came some Midianites and pulled him out of the pit. And he figured that the Midianites were pulling out of the pit because the brothers had told them, had sold Joseph. And they said, okay, he's in the pit over there. Go ahead and take him out of the pit because you bought him. And so I think that's a good explanation for that problem. I'm going to skip this example because I'm running out of time, and I'll give you another example of Rashbam really thinking out of the box. We learned back in grade one or grade two that the verse in Exodus that says "Vayehi erev, vayehi boker, yom echad" teaches us that a Jewish day begins at night and that the evening comes before the day. That's why Erev comes before Boker. Until Rashbam came along and said, no, that's not what the verse means. It means that God created, and then there was evening, and then there was morning. And Rashbam writes, there was evening and there was morning one day. The text does not write, there was night and there was day, which is what the standard traditional Jewish understanding is trying to argue, that first there was night and then there was day. Rather, it writes there was evening. In other words, the light of the first day subsided and darkness fell. And there was morning, the morning that comes at the end of the night when dawn broke. At that point, one day of those 6 days described in the Decalogue was completed, and then the second day began when God said, let there be an expanse. When did the first day end? The first day ended in the morning. God created during the first day, and then there was evening, and then there was morning, and when morning came, that was the end of the first day. And this is, psychologically, this is what we all think about a day. If you're up tonight at 2 o'clock in the morning and somebody asks you what day it is, you're going to say that it's Tuesday. If you're up tonight at 9 o'clock in the evening and halakha says that it's already Wednesday, none of us actually really believe that it's Wednesday at night. And we don't even believe that it's Wednesday at midnight, even though the law of Canada says that, and of the United States says that the day begins at midnight. We all think that the day begins when we wake up the next morning. And Rashbam is saying that that's what was going on during the creation in Genesis chapter 1. We will see next week that Rashbam did not win that many friends by offering this interpretation of the text. When you think about it, it's actually not that radical because this is a narrative text, and other texts that Rashbam has written make it extremely clear that Rashbam feels that the halachic day begins in the evening and ends in the evening. But this narrative day, he said, began, these narrative days of the story of creation began in the morning and finished in the morning. So this is it's a surprising interpretation that's going against the standard Jewish interpretation, but it isn't as radical as various other things that he wrote, including, and we'll just finish off with some texts from this week's Parsha, where Rashbam explains halachic texts in a pshat that is not the same as what the halacha is, and in fact contradicts the halacha. We have here the verse in this week's parasha, Lo yitama ba'al be'amav leheichalo. Extremely, one of the most difficult verses in the Torah, but Rashbam understands it to mean, no husband from the company of priests shall defile himself by becoming impure through contact with the dead body of his wife. The context here is it says that a Kohen is not allowed to go to a funeral, and he's not allowed to go to a funeral unless it's a relative of his, and a relative is defined as being mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter. And after the verse that lists those six relatives, it says, Lo yitama ba'al be'amav leheichalo. And Rashbam says that means that a priest, a Kohen, is not allowed to go to his, is not allowed to go to his wife's funeral when she dies, and which is against halacha. And of course, Rashbam knows the halacha extremely well, and he knows that not only does a Kohen go to his wife's funeral, not only is it permitted for a Kohen to go to his wife's funeral, he is required to do so. The Talmud says that if the priest says, oh, I'm not going to my wife's funeral, the Talmud says, "Mitamin oto be'al korcho." You force him to go there to the cemetery and to become tamei by going to the cemetery. And he says, but according to the rabbis, that isn't what the verse means. It means if it's a woman that he shouldn't have been married to in the first place, then he shouldn't go to her her funeral. But if it was a woman that he was allowed to be married to in the first place, then he can go to that funeral. So what does it mean to say, this is the big mystery of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, that after all these years of studying it, I will admit that I haven't solved to my satisfaction or to anybody else's satisfaction. What does it mean to say that the pshat, what does it mean when a halachically observant Jew like Rashbam, who is so loyal to the tradition, there's no question that he's loyal to the tradition. There's no question that he was not a halachic revolutionary. He was not suggesting changes in halacha, but he says, actually the pshat says the opposite of what halacha says. Halacha says that a Kohen has to go to his wife's funeral, and the pshat says the opposite, that he's not allowed to go to his wife's funeral. Modern people have offered suggestions of this nature and have said that, like, for example, they might say that the rabbis were legislators and that they changed the halacha. Some people have even said that, like, the nature of marriage changed from biblical times until rabbinic times. And in rabbinic times, there was already a closer relationship between husbands and wives. In antiquity, it's clear in ancient Greek literature and in other forms of literature from antiquity that the strongest relationship that somebody had was with their blood relatives. If any of you have ever read the Antigone, in the Antigone, Antigone, who breaks the law to bury her brother, has this very strange line where she says, I broke the law to bury my brother, even though I knew that I would be there was a death penalty for burying him, and I would never have done this for a husband, because if you lose a husband, you can always find another husband. But a brother, now that my parents are dead, how in the world am I going to get another brother? And this idea that the closest form of a relationship that somebody had was with their blood relatives, and that could be the pshat of what the Torah is saying here, that a Kohen is allowed to go to a funeral, but only of a close blood relative, mother, father, brother, sister, son, daughter, but not a wife who is not a blood relative. But then, as the nature of marriage changed over the years, okay, is it possible that Rashbam had an attitude like that and said that the rabbis were legislators changing the text? I don't think so. I don't really believe that that was the kind of attitude that he took to this issue. I think that he really believed that a text has multiple levels of meaning to it, and we're going to live our life according to the halachic level of meaning, but there's also the pshat level of meaning of the biblical text. This leaves a theological question unanswered. Why would God write the pshat of the Torah in a way that contradicts what it is that he wants us to be doing? If you assume that God wants the Kohen, in Rashbam's understanding, of course, God is the ultimate author of this text. God wants the Kohen to go to his wife's funeral. So why does he write it in such a way that the pshat says that he doesn't go to his wife's funeral? It is possible that the fact that Rashbam is living on the line, living on the edge like this, living with this tension, was another one of the reasons that this commentary got lost, and that people did not pay that much attention to it, because people were totally surprised by an approach like this that said that the pshat of the text could offer an interpretation that is against the halachic interpretation. But now in the 21st century, Rashbam is making a little bit of a comeback, and there are more and more people who are taking an interest in Rashbam's commentary. And, you know, to put it simply, I'm attracted to Rashbam, who allowed himself the intellectual freedom to explore new ways of understanding without organizing a rebellion against the standard halachic system. He did not feel that there was, that offering a new kind of interpretation of the text, even if it looks to be contradictory to halacha, necessarily constitutes a rebellion against halacha. And that's an approach that I personally find very, very attractive. Okay, I'm going to